So, Katie, are we doing Donna Haraway today, or have things changed?
Yeah. No, that sounds great.
I'm ready. Let me say this. Are you aware of the book Body Drift by Arthur Croker?
No.
So it's a book on three female intellectuals, Butler, Hales, and Haraway. So I'm open to the Haraway chapter. I'm ready for what you're going to bring on.
Okay. So is that the only Haraway that you've read? I'm just curious.
No, I've read all kinds of stuff. William Irwin Thompson started talking about her at our first seminars in 1993, the fall of 93 in New York City. And he was talking about her, so I looked at her work.
I'm interested to see where she fits into the whole conversation because she's not a media ecologist. She's a biologist and a feminist. And I got interested in her because I got Life in the Wires, Croker's book.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
and
collection of essays.
And I thought it was going to be all the Crokers, and it's not. It's a collection of essays. And they right away mentioned Donna. And it was interesting the context in which they mentioned her because it's in the very beginning of this book, Life in the Wires, which kind of mirrors Marshall in that they, instead of saying without walls, without walls, without walls, in terms of everything that they're analyzing, it's all in the wires, in the wires, in the wires. So it would be net in the wires, politics in the wires, music in the wires, cities in the wires, screens in the wires. So I don't know if they did that on purpose because it was kind of like what Marshall was trying to do, but I thought that was interesting. And right away, they started talking about Donna in the context of how Desjardins and Marshall McLuhan, they mentioned those two people, Talleyrand and Marshall, thought that we would usher in a technological utopia. And that was kind of where we left off with Barbara Moggs Hubbard. That's what she claimed was going to happen, that we were going to get this technology, our nervous system would be externalized through all of the connectivity that we have, and then it would usher in a time where basically everybody could be praying together, all connected on the Internet. So instead of using it for porn, we would be using it to usher in the new age. And how that isn't really what happened. And then go ahead, what were you going to say?
Well, just right away, that's Croker's subterfuge, his deception. He always says, for the general left audience he's writing for, that McLuhan was the utopian, techno-utopian. And he's very wrong on that point, but I let him get away with it because he had to say on the left that McLuhan was what the left thought he was to even get a hearing. But he really is working for McLuhan, and he started writing that way 30 years ago. And you can see what he says about McLuhan on the centenary. He still has a deeper understanding of McLuhan than he presented in those essays or his writings. But that was his strategy. I hope that was his strategy. I give him the benefit of the doubt. He knows better. But he had to sort of say, okay, I'm going to teach you guys about McLuhan, but of course I'm not a McLuhanite, and of course he was wrong, and he was a dumb Catholic, blah, blah, blah. So just that's a proviso there, what he's saying there about
McLuhan. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So he was like McLuhan in the sense that just because he was saying it doesn't mean that he meant
what
he was saying. Okay, got it. So then he starts to talk about Donna Haraway and her cyborg manifesto. I don't know if you read that. That was her main thing that she wrote when she was like 40. It was 1985. Yeah. She's 70 now. And that reminded me a lot of maybe a precursor to the five bodies. She basically says that we're cyborgs, not necessarily literally in terms of being like, you know, Blade Runner or the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, Terminator or whatever that thing was. Like not as, or the Bionic Woman, even though all those things are really real, what she was talking more about was how we view our body as a machine. And there's some neat examples about how like 100 or so years ago there wasn't even a right and left shoe. People just wore shoes that were the same on both feet, and now we've got a shoe for every activity and like millions of kinds of even running shoes. And then our whole nutraceutical industry is trying to rewire our bodies all to be like optimally performing. She wrote it so long ago, it's amazing the conclusions that she came to before the advent of any cell phones, iPads, iPhones, Google Glass, all that stuff. So she was kind of a futurist in that sense.
And yeah, really can you read something? Can you read something from that period to show that?
Well, just in general. I mean, without,
okay.
I could, but there's the whole thing. A cyborg is a cybernetic organism, a hybrid of machine and organism, a creature of social reality as well as a creature of fiction. Social reality is lived in social relations, a most important political construction, a world-changing fiction. The international women's movements have constructed women's experience as well as uncovered or discovered its crucial collective object. This experience is a fiction and fact of the most crucial political kind. Liberation rests on the construction of the consciousness, the imaginative apprehension of oppression, and so of possibility. The cyborg is a matter of fiction and lived experience that changes what counts as women's experience in the late 20th century. So she's talking about us being cyborgs, and
says
she would rather be a cyborg than a goddess back in 1985 when everything was still binary.
Just was starting. Spiritual feminism was just starting to, you know, with Starhawk and them were just starting to get attention. Yes, she was the hidden ground at that point in feminism.
In feminism. So what she's saying is similar to what you said with the five body stuff, which has been a key piece for me, is that all the issues of feminism don't matter if you can do anything you want to your body. So your role and your identity isn't limited at all to the physical body because you can do whatever you want with it, including taking hormones and transgendering.
Yeah.
Another interesting part of being a cyborg is that all the origin and creation stories are no longer relevant because you just replicate on your own. So it doesn't matter about genesis and you don't have to die. And that's interesting in terms of what we're talking about, living forever and things like that. And then it's really liberating for anybody who's considered queer in whatever way, because sex can no longer be seen as anything that's like wrong because it's not limited to reproduction at all anymore because the cyborg can self-replicate. It doesn't have to use sex to generate. So, do you have anything to say about all of that? When was the date that you can... Go ahead.
Go ahead. When was the day what?
I was just going to ask, when did you come up with your five-bodied stuff, like the date on your timeline of that? And where did you fall?
You look in the diaries, you look on February 2nd or 3rd, 1978, my... first conversation with Reverend Stang and Philo Drummond, you will see me laid out there. I didn't use the word bodies, but you can see what I'm talking about. Maybe we'll bring that up in a minute. I get a chance to go.
So you were before her by a good 7 or 8 years.
But not in public. I had the agenda in the 80s of explaining McLuhan the way even Donna Haraway didn't understand. See, she's writing about the cyborg. Marshall wrote about the cyborg in the 60s. The word came in around then, and he was on it really fast, and he explained that Western man was a cyborg since the printing press. So you need to have the change in perception of what you think cyborg is, and this is what Donna Haraway doesn't know, is that we actually were becoming a non-cyborg, or at least the autonomous side of it, not a robot, an autonomous side of it in the 80s with the Android meme. And that gradually got developed to Web 2.0, you know, 20 years later. So I didn't start talking about the five bodies till the 90s, I think, around the time of the Android meme. But I had my agenda in the 80s, and then the albums came out that explained that, and then I was not doing a radio show, so I was able to do more advanced stuff, which is what I started doing in Flipside magazine in 1995 or so, publishing my diaries. But certainly 5body.com did not get created until 2006, that website. So on the public level, the blatant public level, mainstream access, I'm 20 years behind her. But I'm ready to talk about what she did and what she missed. And, I mean, she's ended up totally involved with pets now. Now, McLuhan said media were pets back in the 60s. But anyways, she was very important for the argument. I was saying in the 80s, I was talking about the word cyberspace, which William Gibson had coined around 1984 in his novel Neuromancer. And cyberspace was just a new version of McLuhan's discarnate penis or discarnate experience, a superangelization. So I kept arguing with...
And she talks about like the clitoris as being a way to access higher realms. So it's interesting that she's going to focus on that when other people are talking about their penis.
Right, and before I forget, The Life in the Wires is a collection of essays from the Croker's online journal called Sea Theory. CTHEORY.net. Now, if you go there, you'll see, and that was started in when he was living in Montreal, and then he moved out to Victoria and got a chair at the University of British Columbia, I guess. No, that's UBC. University of Victoria, I guess. Whatever university's on Vancouver Island. And he got a chair there, and he started PACTAC, P-A-C-T-A-C, and he reversed McLuhan's title of his center was Center for Culture and Technology. Well, Croker made it Center for Technology and Culture, Pacific something, Pacific PACTAC, P-A-T-A-C. Now, if you can go there, he features videos of all the his colleagues coming to speak there, and you can look at a video of Donna Haraway presenting there. That's, if you haven't seen that, you want to watch that. You want to see her.
Yeah, I watched several of her.
Not just the Croker's.
Videos that are... Not just, oh, I didn't see the Croker's at all. I just saw what she has up on YouTube.
Okay, so you've seen her in action.
Talks at her, yeah, she's so weird. I just love her. She can be a bigger nerd. She's
yes,
the biggest
that's right.
nerd.
That's right. In a way, the nerd goes for the discarnate, for the cyborgian, you know. They should have a body-oriented, non-nerd person like Dr. Dean to explain the discarnate, which he does in Chapter 4 of her book, Death, what is it, Death by Modern America? What is it called? Death in Modern America, right.
Yeah.
Dead People in Modern Medicine or something. It's funny, I forgot the title. But she doesn't look like a nerd. You know, and she talks about the body in a new way there. So Haraway, the way she looks to me, she's going to, if she hasn't already gotten ill, she's the type who's on her way because you get that nerdy pallor, you know, nerdy,
mm-hmm.
too much reading science text and all this stuff. Definitely needs some
mm-hmm.
RNA drops. But the
mm-hmm.
William Irwin Thompson, I think, was shocked when he read her in the early 90s. That made him reconsider McLuhan, I think, and I helped him get regrounded on that. But maybe someday I'll get out each talk he gave on a particular book, many of them the New Age feminist books, and he was the first to do that. He's the creator of New Age spiritual feminism, not Rhianne Eisler or anybody else you come up with.
Croker was?
No, Croker William
was?
Irwin Thompson. William Irwin
William
Thompson.
Thompson. Right, okay.
You know, take his book, The Time Falling Bodies Take Delight. Now, why Croker's better than any other feminist you put up against him is that he includes McLuhan. But it wasn't a perfect understanding of McLuhan, but at least he had that part. And he complained recently that the feminists don't acknowledge him, that he laid it out first. And so he was ready to understand Haraway when that showed up in his awareness. So I have... the transcript of many of his lectures he gave us in 92-93. I have the 92 lectures, though we didn't attend them. We started in the fall of 93 when we started living in New York City. Maybe I'll get out the transcript of the Donna Haraway one at some point and read it, you know, sometime in the future. Read what he said or excerpts of about her.
Okay.
But he definitely said she was original and important. And, of course, that's when the Android meme was finished as ground, 1992. We've had the afterimage of the Android meme since the 1990, and that went till 2008. And it's full-blown Iondom after that. So, but back to, now, who was
okay.
it? Somebody, go ahead.
Well, yeah, because this is what I want to know from you before we talk about anything else, is like, how does this all fit together? In all of Donna's bibliographies, there's no mention of Marshall. She is not a media ecologist at all. And now, so to hear Arthur talking about Telyard, Marshall, and Donna, all in the same context. Now I've gone on this huge Donna tangent. I don't quite know how to fit her in with what with the whole story. I did watch some of her other stuff on companion species. I'd love to talk to you about that. Some of it, kind of like a lot of, like that Barbara Marks Hubbard that I talked about a couple weeks ago. Like, she's so close. She's just, you know, just turn that dial a little bit.
Well, she was contemporary.
I don't understand how it fits with media ecology. That's what I want you to tell me.
Okay, Donna. Well, she being a up-to-date professor in the 70s and 80s, the digital cyborging stuff started being in the academic literature in the 80s, and so she would read that. Now, I'd have to look at the manifesto to see who she cites. Does it give credit to who she cites in that manifesto?
Do you want me to read some of them?
Yeah, some of the names, yeah.
Okay, all right. I got to get back to that. Hang on 1 second. Bear with me. I have to turn to the back. It's like a 36-page essay.
Yeah.
Okay. Some French person, I can't even say the name, sorry, Bambara. Now, Baudrillard.
Yeah, Baudrillard,
Bird.
Yeah.
Okay, Blier, Bloomberg, Burke, S.G. Burr, they're all feminists. L. Bush,
right.
O. Butler, Butler and Evans together, Carby, Christian, Clifford, C. Cone, P. Collins, R. Cowan, L. Daston, Derrida, a lot.
Right.
The deconstructionist. Another French guy, I can't say the name, Donofrio.
Yeah,
Douglas,
D'Onofrio.
Dubois. Yeah, lots of French people. Oh, that's
yes.
D'Onofrio. You'd think I would know that. I love Vincent D'Onofrio. Dubois, Duchin, Edwards, Enloe, Epstein, Evans, Fausto Sterling, Fernandez Kelly, Fisher, Flax, Foucault, Frazier, Fuentes, Gates, Gings, Gilbert, Gordon. Do you want me to read any more?
No, that's enough. Mainly you've got Foucault and Baudrillard and Derrida. See, that was what the left was forced to read in the 80s. Reagan had come in. They had to acknowledge the media simulation of Reagan, which they had not been doing really in the 60s and 70s. They weren't reading McLuhan and getting that, and they didn't know that McLuhan predicted Reagan, predicted the whole thing. So there she is trying to understand Baudrillard, who is McLuhan redone and updated, and so is Derrida and Foucault. They're all McLuhan derivatives, but the left will not acknowledge them. At best, they'll acknowledge Walter Benjamin, or Benjamin. He's the theorist from the 30s that they think analyzed media the way McLuhan did, or James Joyce did, or Wyndham Lewis. And so they go for Walter Benjamin. So that's all the kids in college in the 80s are getting, all those people she listed. So she's playing catch-up, but because she's fitting it into a feminist thing, that's her audience. In other words, she's going to say, us feminists got to reconsider what Baudrillard, and she didn't know it, what McLuhan were talking about. We're not limited by our chemical body anymore. So she doesn't know she's in media ecology, and she's such a reader. She's probably like, a polymath, reads science and math and physics, nerdy stuff, and is not inclined
She's really hard to even follow. When you're listening to one of her talks, you have got to listen to every word. She never lets up for a second.
That's right. Yeah, she's a verbal polymath. And and she can't go simple. You got to be able to go simple, you know. She's an academic and a POB, basically a POB trying to understand the present. And let's see what else. So other people would fit her into media ecology. She wouldn't care. She might even be so inclined to not know about McLuhan because she's a pagan. She's not into Catholic writers or that history of Catholicism.
She is a lapsed Catholic, though. She's a lapsed Catholic herself.
Well, that would make her neurotic about her body and all uptight. So that's probably an advantage she had to perceive the threat of the cyborg on her. But because she's not an intellectual Catholic, she doesn't know anything about media ecology or how it came from McLuhan. So I would always be, whenever I came across feminists or people who were into her, I would explain what they were missing, and they wouldn't believe me, and they didn't care. It even got to the point, Don Thiel, who was president of a university, that the left feminists took over academia where they didn't allow the education or teaching of Joyce. Joyce got thrown to the side. That's how bad it got in the 90s. And
wow.
That's part of what our youth show will be about, is educating the kids about stuff they're not going to hear about in their universities. The left behind,
mm-hmm.
the hidden ground of what the kids are actually learning. So let's
mm-hmm.
see what else to say. So that's a good example of Croker using the left, putting on the left, and then doing something on Donna Haraway and throwing in McLuhan. You see, that's how he infiltrated.
Yeah.
So it's very
he also
sneaky what he does.
He presents to me as a lesbian. She might not be. I don't know. She was married to a man who was a practicing homosexual, and then it mentioned in this article that they wanted to have a brother-sister incest but couldn't find another context for their relationship other than marriage. I wasn't sure what that meant.
Who's saying this? I didn't get your... Did you start off saying that Croker said she's a legend? Did you say that?
No. I said that she presents as a lesbian. Like, as I looked at her,
wondering,
is she a lesbian feminist? I was curious about her sexuality because she is exactly what you described. Weird, a lot of, like, kind of... I mean, I love her. I think she is fascinating. But she is probably one of the biggest nerds I've ever seen. And then, like
yeah,
I said, she
yeah.
seems like a lesbian. So I started Googling around to see, like, does she have a girlfriend? What's her deal? And she was married to a man who was practicing gay. He ended up dying of complications due to AIDS.
Right.
And he kind of lived on a commune with people who would, like, have births at home and then eat the placenta. Like, we're talking out there, like, really hippie-ish
yeah,
type
new
person
age.
Living in a commune. But,
that's
like,
William Irwin
didn't have the... didn't seem like she would want to participate in the free love aspect of any of this because she just doesn't
right.
seem sexual. And then she left this whole... First she was, I'd rather be a cyborg than a goddess. And
yeah.
then now, like you said, she's into this whole pet thing, but it's companion species. So she sees cyborgs as companion species and now animals as companion species. She's especially interested in dogs. And she was making some jokes in one of the lectures about, I mean, it was a really mild innuendo, but that she was having sex with her dog. Definitely talking about the dogs darting kisses and exchanging saliva and taking each other's genomes into each other's
yeah.
bodies.
Yeah.
But it almost seemed like she wanted to be more sexual with animals.
She can't get it on with men. So does it say anywhere she's a lesbian? Did it ever say that?
I think she might even like not be like particularly sexual at all.
Right.
Not that it really yep. matters, but when you're looking at issues of gender and reproduction and accepting queer types of sex, I mean, I would just wonder if she would have an agenda for her own sexual, political yearnings.
Right. I think she's a nerd. She's a nerd in relation
yeah.
to sex, and that's why she talks about her pets and her machines. Now, in the Dobbs quadrant, the tiny note chart, for sex, we have the horny device. So she fits into the Dobbs quadrant of looking for horny devices, whether it's a pet or some other thing.
Mm-hmm.
She's included. So... let me just read you what Croker says about her, all right?
Okay.
In this book, Body Drift, which is a perfect title for my stuff, you know, many bodies, and they're drifting, the five bodies. And so he does Judy Butler and how she is Nietzsche in drag, and she's an open lesbian. Or maybe even bisexual. Then there's Catherine Hales, who's more old-fashioned professor looking woman. You can see what she looks like on Croker's PacTac site. And she is Heidegger. She's replayed. So the women replay Nietzsche. That's Judith Butler. And then Catherine Hales replays Heidegger. Now, that's why I have Madonna in my quadrant. It's the Madonna world. It's a replay of a whole tetrad media of men. And then Donna Haraway replays Karl Marx. So he says here, Coker says, Donna Haraway and Bodies of Paradox, and all under the title Hybridities, which is McLuhan's idea of dangerous liaisons, the hybrid media. So he says, in his third essay of these three women, Butler, Hales, and Haraway, there is a painting by the Canadian artist Alex Colville that powerfully captures, although in reverse image, the theoretical imagination of Donna Haraway. Titled Horse and Train, the painting registers an approaching collision of two radically dissimilar forces, the mechanical technology of the speeding train running on its fixed track, and the beautiful but possibly doomed spirit of the horse. No merger of the two is possible. Their only future is either the death of the animal or perhaps one of them suddenly ceding place to the other. The train stops in time or the horse suddenly veers away. With this painting, we are introduced to a deeper discourse on technology as warring solitudes, with neither technological culture nor animal nature having any part of a shared destiny, unless the question of the technological future also alludes or refers to the prospect of extinguishment. And then he says, the theoretical canvas of Donna Haraway is the very opposite of Alex Colville's vision. So it's the opposite of this warring solitudes. So she's going to go along with the merger of the two. Where her mm-hmm. images of technology are as meticulously word-painted from the literature of cyborgs, zombies, aliens, and misfits to the sciences of paleontology, biology, anthropology, and women's history, and her images of the companion species, dogs, horses, birds, apes, chimpanzees, which we are in theory and among which we circulate in practice, are as passionately visualized as Colville's Horse and Train, so all of that, her thought always rises to a greater sense of hybridity, or intermingling, to a critical understanding that out of the impossibility of this collision of horse and train, or chemical body and chip body, might yet emerge a difference that inspires social justice. Always at the edge of her thought, yet deeply imminent, meaning pervasive, within its detailed critical realism, there is that elusive presence of a third term not yet articulated, a godless cyborg not yet recognized, a primate feminism not yet theorized, an overcoming of the oncomos not yet happening, a transformative science not yet initiated. Now, I just want to read the first previous part again. So it says, when her images of technology are as meticulously word-painted from literature, women's history, and biology, which we are all, that's, in other words, she does go through the literature of the division of the warring solitudes of the chemical body versus the virtual body. She attempts to go to a third level, and that definitely would be Croker's effort, approach, methodology. Mm-hmm. So she's a Crokerian. Because Croker's not going to fall back to nature, that's the Thompson Quadrant, not mm-hmm. go forward to totally embracing a capitulation to technology, but trying to find an opening, a gap of autonomy for the new being to survive and flourish. So he's saying that this is what she does. And because she's Marx, it goes towards social justice, a traditional Marxist concern. That's her emphasis, whereas Haraway and Butler emphasize other things. So now, I've just said that. Now, what would you say, you have a quote or something you want to say?
Well, I just want clarification from you. Something that I thought was interesting is, so you think about machines as being an extension of us, and then she talks about merging. And now,
right.
And then she kind of gave all that up, and when she's talking about the animals, companion species, she's talking about merging with them, and I can get into some of the details of things that she talks about. It is quite interesting. And I think of animals as non-physical. So,
no, we can't bring that in. When we're talking about her, we can't bring an eye on. We're speaking, we can speak from that, but we're trying to talk to her on her terms. That's what this is the first part of the show where we deal with the physical. The old traditional physical.
She has no inkling that animals are non-physical?
Nobody knows that. Most people think animals are more physical than us. You know, nobody knows, agrees with Ion or even knows that. You know, it's a great insight once you understand what Ion's saying. But no, nobody, she doesn't know about Ion.
I thought maybe she did. I thought maybe she was, some of the, like she talks about the story of how dogs were domesticated and how the typical story is that we set an intention to dominate the dogs so that we could use them to do work. And that really isn't the case. That really, it's about love. The dogs and humans love each other, and we get infected with love for each other due to the kisses, because they kiss us and the saliva mixes. Really, she's talking about this. And so I just thought maybe that on, like, even a subconscious level, if she doesn't know what she's talking about, that somehow she was tapping into that.
Well, would she agree, if she would understand Ion, if she agreed with Ion that all animal diseases are picked up from their owners, their hosts, would she say that? You know, look for if she would say something like that. Because she did.
I don't
with
think
the,
she'd go that necessarily.
That's
she
right.
would say she it would was go. More physical, that it would have to do with, like, a bacteria or something.
Because she's a nerd. She's a scientist. She's actually devoted to the chemical body and obsessed with how to hybridize the chemical and the discarnate, the virtual. We don't, here at Five-Bodied, we don't worry about that. We say we've been cyborg on the virtual level, not the hardware robot, which is 400 years under, but the electric cyborg, we've been that way since radio. So we're used to those images, you know, Terminator and Blade Runner. Don't surprise Dobbstown.com. What I was pointing to was the breakthrough of the hexatic, though I called it MIR, Carol's Medical Technology, and cold fusion. And we then had the accurate offering of that through Ion. So I never got stuck with those people. Mainly, I got protected from the retrieval of McLuhan via the left's reading Baudrillard and Foucault, and they didn't know it was McLuhan. Even Baudrillard played down it was McLuhan for 10 or 15 years. But it all came through the book called the series of books called Semiotext, put out by Severo Lestrange at Columbia University in the French department. He was a student of Roland Barthes and grew up in French, probably at the Sorbonne, wherever they taught high education there in the 1560s. So he knew all these guys, and when he came to New York in the 70s, he had an interest in art and John Cage and William Burroughs and that. So he thought that the art world needed French, what was going to be called French theory. So he started publishing Semiotext in the 70s, and then it became these little books that he told me he perfectly wanted to create, these little books like The Medium is the Massage, the little black and white paperback that McLuhan put out. He modeled his books on McLuhan, so the people who are on the subway or going to work can put the little book in their purse, in their pocket almost, and read these short books/essays. And he was there propagating Baudrillard, Foucault, and Derrida, and Barthes, the people that Donna has to quote. Because in academia, she may be a Shirley come lately, because she's dealing with what Severo is putting out through Semiotext, which started in 83 or so. By 85, she's trying to process. And you'll find most of these new books by academics over the last 30 years, they're just processing their course reading or the reading they do for their course. And they're trying to figure out what they're going to talk about or write about. You know, with thousands of titles being published every year, it's hard to do it. So she's playing catch up there, but and the feminists are so whacked out, so gone, and they get all burned out in the Reagan era and don't even get ERA passed, that she had a whole opening that appeared to be new, you know what I mean? Really new for the whatever feminist dared reader. Can you imagine yourself, was it 10 or more years ago, you're with Marianne Williamson, and you found her thing in the middle of Williamson? Now, what would you have thought of that? You know, the cyborg manifesto.
I wouldn't have gotten it then.
Yes, it was not even in your frequency.
No, I wouldn't have understood it. I wouldn't have been able to even listen to her. I wouldn't have been able to read anything. It would never have. I mean, I had to get I had to work with you before I would have.
Yeah.
Anyway, so no, I would have never even found it, and if I did, I wouldn't have been able to understand a word of it for sure.
And you would see that many baby boomer women will go into the Thompson Quadrant and spiritual feminism, variations of that. It's Generation X, which actually didn't grow up with the computers, but as they became professors in the 30s and 40s, they knew the New Age stuff couldn't work anymore. They couldn't do that in university, so then mm-hmm. they grabbed on to Donna Haraway. And then you have the Generation Y and Z, they grew up with computers. They don't have an issue with the cyborg. They can understand it and adapt to it or use it real quickly if they're in university, but mm-hmm. they don't have a problem like the baby boomers do have had with it. There was Joan of Arc who ran Paranoia magazine, and that's the one that interviewed me in 2000 and 2004 or 5 or something. So Joan was a intellectual, a conspiracy theorist, probably a leftist, an anarchist, and all these things. Right when she joined FiveBody.com, about 2006 or 7, she just happened to be at a book fair and came across Donna Haraway and or someone like her, and she read it or looked at it and said, "What the heck is this?" She wasn't a total New Ager, but she was familiar with that stuff. I think she was more of a radical humanist, you know, free thinking, and just didn't like, sort of like a LaRouche. And she immediately wrote in later that day that she was in shock reading this stuff about that we were cyborg. And she says, now I know what five-bodied means. And there's right. a whole thread, you can go back and find it, where she has this identity crisis trying to process Donna Haraway. And that was pretty interesting, but go ahead.
You'd have to be ready for that identity crisis, though, in order to accept it. And to be a female, especially a New Age female, you have to be really sick of that fight, that none of that stuff works, because it's just a propping up of the old, the Bible and the masculine role, but through the feminine and you know, it's all the same thing. It's just under a New Age label. You have to be, and so it's fun for a while to be like mad at men and say girl power and all this kind of stuff, but then you realize that it doesn't work, and you have to be at that frustrated place, and then you can hear, you don't need to fight because gender's irrelevant, but you have to go through that struggle before you're ready to give it up. That's what I think.
Right, and you might bask in the glory of not being in the fight anymore for 5 or 10 years. You're not really a feminist, but you watch and observe and make up patterns about the obsolescence of Hillary or Gloria Steinem, and that engages your mind for a while. But then you get frustrated. Then you're sick of being aware of the fallacies of feminism, and that's when you start looking and yearning for something, and then Dobbstown shows up, and that happens. Now, we got Carolyn saying, bring in the non-physical Katie. Don't listen to Bob. We will get to the non-physical Connie. But it's good. You know, I say the first part of the show is mind. The second part, if Ion shows up, it's non-physical. And then the third is physical in the new Ionic way. And that usually focuses on me and my wonderful life because nobody else has anything to say. And I'm just talking to myself with whoever is into me at that point. That's 10 hours down the way, right? But we're showing where the literary world went and where it came from and the background, because you will see, the more you understand what we're talking about, that Ion is so contemporary. His theology, his platitudes are so what people like Donna Haraway and that are saying. Now, he means more. He means more, but the words on the level, anybody in college would have to agree with Ion saying if they're living in Web 2.0. They got to say, I edit my own reality, you know, and I have to relax now because there's so much information coming at me. And these platitudes actually fit for the lifestyle of the chip body. And and so if you don't know that about Ion, how Ion is speaking to social mortar accurately and playing off it, then you don't have a deep understanding of Ion. You don't know what Ion's address, what the problem is that Ion came in to address. On top of the part of Ion that says, we will not change our words, Bob, and that's the non-physical part and the power of the word. Now, who's his phone? It's Corbin. Corbin's calling on the other line. Corbin left a whole bunch of messages in the half hour before the show started. And I always have to just let them run through because I got the blinking light, which bothers me in the corner of my eye. And so I click on it, and I don't listen to it, but it runs through. Like, he left six messages. So he's calling now to complain that why don't I bring him in? Well, you just got to have to wait. This is Katie's time. And if Katie's interesting, she gets as long as she wants. Katie actually does some work, Corbin. You don't even know what page we're on or anything other than your weird experiences in L.A., which are fun. But let's hear this.
You're having right now with Katie, it has to do with Franklin Delano Roosevelt and how his wife Elizabeth is actually a lesbian. And there's some letters that have just come to surface that showing her, her persuasion. Okay, I'm calling back in. Put me on the phone because I don't have hours to hang out. Just
he sounds kind of articulate tonight. What's he saying that Franklin Delano, that Eleanor Roosevelt was what?
Yeah, it was a lesbian, which we all knew, and he calls her Elizabeth. So let me just bring in Corbin for a minute.
Bring in Corbin.
Yeah. And just see if he can make any relevance here. Well, we'll be on his case pretty quickly. All right.
Okay.
He's not on. Corbin, you're not there. You fell off the line. So I guess, so he's going to have to call back in, right? He had to call me. He probably doesn't have call forwarding. I do see O.J. there. I met with O.J. a week or so ago. What was it on? January 8th. And this is the, what would the 8th be? Thursday, I think. Yes, Thursday. Hmm. Okay, so there's Corbin. We'll bring him in. Okay, Corbin, it's Eleanor, not Elizabeth, as far as I remember. Oh, what's the matter? Can you speak? Go ahead. Speak, Corbin. Demute yourself.
I'm trying.
Yeah, now we can hear you. We can hear you. So isn't it Eleanor rather than Elizabeth?
You're probably correct on that. I've just discovered this material this past week. There's been a book released between Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the only president to be elected four times in four consecutive terms because the country is in such turmoil by his, it's almost like Reagan, like by the second term, Nancy Reagan was running the White House because of his Alzheimer's condition. And that's why we're feeling the brutal brunt of what's going on. You know, the good old days are over, kiddies. It's bye-bye.
That's not true. The good old days are back with Dobbstown. Come on, Corbin. We're not...
Okay, Dobbstown, but you talk to the average person on the street where I live.
Yes.
The second largest homeless population in the nation next to New York City. After you had spent 12 years there, you said, I've got to get the frick out of here. what's her name? Did we get
Katie. Or Kate. Katie or Kate. What do you prefer, Kate? Does it matter?
Katie. Katie.
All right, Katie. Well, anyway, the woman's name is Hickok. Is she had, there's 2,000, let me see if I can get my, all right, there's 2,336 letters between Hickok Franklin Delano's Roosevelt's wife's name? Her first name?
Eleanor.
Eleanor, okay. Between Hickok and Eleanor, I don't know the actual, I think her name was Levonrand. They have basically 2,336 letters. because it was so uncool. That's back in Victorian times of lesbianism. And she would write her letters like, "Oh, I ache to hold you." You know, just that simple sublimation could be construed on so many levels, and the FBI, the CIA, you know, all the government's men were so all over it. Besides, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in a wheelchair in his last term of office, okay? And he's basically the guy, that was the last, what they called the good war. Basically, what it was setting us up for was the war economy. The, you know, basically everything Lockheed Martin, Boeing, every defense contract that you can imagine that is now is just spun out of control. I mean, when we're paying $26 billion for a plane that doesn't even work, at where, and they're just doing it as a write-off, I mean, imagine if we were putting that into our country. Instead, no, we have to go protect Afghanistan. We have to protect the terrorists, Yemen, Syria, all the above.
How does this relate to Donna Haraway and our topic on the feminist?
The lesbian thing was way under wraps. It was frickin' way under wraps.
Yeah.
Not by the time Donna Haraway was. She could have.
What?
Now, Donna Haraway was. In the 80s, she could be a lesbian if she wanted.
I'm not talking about Donna Haraway in the 80s. I'm talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's wife, Eleanor. She was a lesbian, and if it had been known by the mass, you know, population, if it had been on Fox 11 News like we accept it today, that's how things have changed. Everybody just kind of blinks an eye, oh, they're a lesbian. They're transgender. They have this sexual need. How about the one guy, who's the skater, Bruce Hamilton, or what's his name? He had the full surgery done.
Just a minute, Corbin. Okay, so it's a big problem. It would have been shocking for a lesbian. What about that maybe she was an E.T.? When will that be known? Yeah, maybe she's an extraterrestrial. Can you accept that? You're shocked.
What we do know is she saved the nation. That won't be denied. And if she was an E.T., that's fabulous. But there is no actual residue proof of other. Once you leave the planet, you bring back a certain residue of various astral belts.
I don't know what your point. Okay, you're saying it would have been shocking. Yes, it would have been shocking. Everybody's known about Eleanor for 20 years. It's been common knowledge. Maybe the letters are new. I don't know when that was published. But everybody's known about Eleanor for a long time in American gossip. I don't know how much they knew in the
30s. No, they have not. They have not, Bobby.
You don't think people know about Eleanor? I heard ever since the 80s it was written up in the Village Voice, and people always talked about Eleanor all the time. It's
right, but now wouldn't you say she was the most radical lesbian, but had to keep everything under taps, basically for government security, as we're speaking about this.
Maybe that's what Hoover had over Roosevelt, and Roosevelt made a lot of bad news.
Of course, Hoover had everything in his back pocket. And guess what? What did he like?
Oh, that's not true. He was not a homosexual. That's what it
is. He was a true homosexual, Bobby.
No, he wasn't.
Yes,
I knew the guy. I met the guy.
I've seen the pictures.
All right. Let me explain those pictures. I had to mute Corbin. What Hoover did, he was with his good buddy, whatever his name was, Clyde, was it? And for Hoover to get out of the heavy responsibilities of his position, which was a very paranoid position that he had, to get out of himself, he used to do cross-dressing. And he'd only do it in front of Clyde or whatever the guy was. And if you have a picture of him in women's clothes, that's because he was cross-dressing. And I talked to Hoover about it after he died, about it was a way of him to think differently. And Clyde didn't mind it. And so he was not a homosexual, but he did do cross-dressing privately as a way, it's like taking marijuana. It was a way of getting out of your rut, groovy rut thinking. So, and groovy comes from rut. Remember grooves? So groovy got flipped with TV. So bring Corbin back in. So there are the facts, Corbin.
So basically you're saying he didn't inhale? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, he didn't inhale. Right.
He did. Well, there's pictures of him inhaling way deeply.
You cannot take any. Mute you. You can't take any pictures today as based on actuality, because everything can be done virtually. So the photographic eyeball evidence, as Ion says, don't believe what you can see, is a fact since the 80s. I always remember Carolyn founded the chronic fatigue thing with Maggie Burstyn. she had a in Toronto, and she had a leftist intellectual daughter, and they were on CBC in the late 80s. She and her other feminists discussing about the virtual reality and how you can't believe any photograph. And that's 30, 25 years ago. So I always think of Maggie Burstyn and her daughter and dealing with the virtual reality. So I've unmuted you again, Corbin.
All right. So basically we'll leave it at this. It doesn't matter your gender, what you've done. You are forgiven for everything that you've done in any sexual form. Now, how do you feel about pedophiles, Bob?
Oh, I like them. They're on my chart under horny device.
Yeah. Okay. Now I can be humorous about this, but no, they should be hung up at dawn and executed. You do not touch a child.
Okay. So
you didn't get my message earlier. They drop me off at the orphanage earlier, man. And my father, he dropped me off. They didn't bring me to the orphanage. They just said, fuck it, man. And they just, I look back.
Okay, I actually heard that high-pitched voice when I started the replay of my message just so they could run through, but I didn't listen to it, Corbin. I just heard you doing the voice. Now, we're going to emphasize Katie. Katie, do you see any way of redeeming Corbin here? Has he said anything that's relevant to our topic on the cyborg?
No, and I just hope that Donna Haraway really is a lesbian, because that's an assumption that I've made, and now we've, like, taken that as a huge tangent. She might not even be.
Right.
And
Corbin's missing the point. He's missing the point is that those issues, he's saying, boy, it was so different back then, 80 years ago. Yeah, it was an earlier, simpler media diet. The goal for the media is the general markers of the changes. I mean, you've got five bodies now. How could anybody be too uptight about somebody's chemical body preference?
Sure. You know, irrelevant.
Yeah, so we know why it's changed. I've talked to some young people. They don't even know, if they're Canadians, they don't even know there was a prime minister named Trudeau. Everything that's on my chart is not known. I mean, it's too old. We'd have to put, I don't know, would you put on Kim Kardashian on there or something to even begin,
right.
And she's on the way out. You know, the imagery, I don't think parents realize the imagery their kids have is nowhere near what they did. So you've got a society where people's images aren't even on the same page between the generations. You can't have a common history.
Right. Well, in the Downton Abbey, I know you've seen the whole season 5 because you watched it ahead of time, but I'm watching it as it's broadcast here. So this week's episode was when they got the wireless to hear the king speak.
Yes.
And everybody's standing in front of the wireless, and the servants are whispering to each other, can he hear us?
I know, it's really good the way they do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the neat parts about Downton Abbey is they're trying to show the technology. You remember the old dowager lady, whatever she is, couldn't understand the phonograph. I remember that scene.
Yeah.
Remember she was saying
that? Yeah. Those are the best, there's a lot of good parts, but that's one of the really good parts.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and here's the other thing. So Donna wrote the Cyborg Manifesto back in 1985 when she was 40. She's 70 now. She's still lecturing, and she really did use what the Cyborg Manifesto gave her in terms of making all of that irrelevant to move on. She does not talk about that anymore. She's into this whole companion species thing now. And
well, you know what I would say about that? You know what she got into? The Android meme makes itself invisible as much as possible. So Web 2.0 is not cyborgian the way that it was a problem with the Bionic Woman level and the 80s level.
Mm-hmm.
It is so not there for children that they think that their chemical body has come back. In other words, media was always bigger, and the worry was that the cyborg and the virtual reality would just get rid of humanity. But the Android meme is getting rid of humanity differently, and on that level, it's being seductive because it's saying, no, no, we're shrinking, we're going away, and you've got this little iPhone that can do a million things, and it's tiny. It's not a big threatening radio public address system.
Mm-hmm.
So the Android meme is making media become comfortable. And not even, you can't even use the word term media anymore. So everything's becoming a nice little pet, maybe even a goldfish. What would be the smallest pet that people, a pet rock or something. So here is Donna Haraway changing with the technology and not making an issue about being a cyborg. That means she's still seduced and doesn't get the hidden ground. Nobody gets what I'm pointing out. Coker gets it pretty good, but nobody in academia gets realizes they're being seduced into saying, oh, we're not cyborg anymore. Everything's returned to a friendly, user-friendly human scale of media. And that was what my point was for 10 years. And then Ion changed the game radically, you know, so it was a whole other level. But you could say that the wonderful humanizing, human scale of the web 1.0 and 2.0 meant that we get to the most human of ourselves, the non-physical. We needed to get to the, I'm friendly and my media are my pets, they're companion species. Then that brings in the original pet, your non-physical. So you can actually say non-physical logically comes out of the phase that Donna's in now where she's not worried about the cyborg.
Okay, so when I say she's just a turn of the dial away, I guess that's more what I mean. She's probably not going to see it, but she is right before Ion, right before.
Yes, yeah. And the changes she went through, where she'll fuck anything that moves now, you know, and call him a pet or a companion species.
Yeah.
Probably.
Species. Well, because she.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you.
No, you go ahead. No, I don't have anything. You go ahead.
You started saying because she. It's an important thought you were going to.
Well,
because she.
She sees them as kind of the, like she sees a cyborg as a companion species and an animal as a companion species and talks about issues of kin and kind and companions and messmates and who's at the table together and who's eating and who's being eaten. And then Croker talks about this whole thing about like brand culture. So in that sense.
What culture? What culture?
Brand. Brand, like
oh, bland, B-R-A-N-D. boring culture.
No, brand, no.
Oh, B-R-A-N-D. Brand culture, okay.
Consumer culture. So now Web 2.0 is all being used to get us associated with the brand, and like
you
on
know what
Facebook
that is?
Now.
That okay, but that what that is? That's the TV iconography, the TV body, getting more and more obsolete. And it's so much of a cliche that people do not find it a threat, so they don't have moral conscience like they did in the 60s, 70s, 80s of selling out. What's wrong with our TV body? It's an old species. And so the branding takes over as the people accepting that the TV landscape is here to stay pretty well in the economy, and they're just referring to that because you don't want to be a brand in the chip body, though the chip body people tell you, you have to become a brand to get noticed as a chip body. But nobody wants to live and deal with chip body, with branding. They want to deal with new gangly experience they get 24/7. You know, you can't control the chip body. You can't even say what's happening to you. You just have a lot to engage to the degree you can take it. Branding is the last gasp of the TV body. But it is a minor phenomenon because, and you could say branding doesn't work anymore because the whole TV version of the economy that came out of the iconography of Wall Street collapsed a few years ago. So branding probably doesn't work. And what I was just hearing somebody talk about that the record industry moguls, they monitor the social media, the extreme social media sites to find out what the kids, probably somebody was talking about it on What Youth on Tuesday, Jermaine or somebody, pointing out that they scan the social media to find out the obscure places where the kids have gathered temporarily. And somebody said, well, they're trying to find out what we like. Well, we don't know what we like, and it changes. So the kids don't even have preferences. They're just going to respond to the mandate to have newness all the time. So marketing is totally obsolete. And it's only to the degree that we want a centralized bureaucracy, a White House, a Wall Street, that branding even has a reality. You know what, you know what I'm saying? You get a glimpse of what I'm saying here? So what's Coker say about it? Why do you bring that up, branding culture?
Because he talks about that as being like how technology has its hooks in us, which sounded similar to me in the way that a lot of these media, like you just are forced to feed it. Like you just keep posting, you keep tapping, you're not even searching for things. Like we've talked about that in the speaking behavior, looking, searching, surfing the web. But this was more about like just feeding the Android meme, that might not be the right word, but feeding
is a two-way process. Think of a pig spinning its wake. We are its consumers and we are its producers. You can't make a difference between biology and technology and non-technology and the non-physical. And that's well laid out in Finney's Wake in the style of its writing. So we live that way, and that seems to be what Donna's caught up with. She's accepting anything as a companion species.
Yeah.
And that's what most people have had to do. Let me read you the next paragraph. This gives you some of the books. And let's just see. It's difficult to follow, maybe, but I try to read it slowly. So,
let me say this before you begin to read. But the difference between the cyborg as companion species and the animal kingdom as companion species is she does talk about this love.
Where you think she's close to non-physical. That's what she's yearning for. That's where
And I'm projecting my own, because I know my animals are my non-physical, and I live with 34 chickens, 2 dogs, 2 cats, 2 parakeets, 2 goats, and a horse. And everybody's in harmony, and all the cats snuggle with the dogs, and they don't eat the chickens, and like it's really harmonious. And my dogs are completely obedient. But I didn't train them. It's just because I live with them. So I can point, and they'll go away. Maybe I'm projecting. She's got her dog's agility trained, and she uses a clicker training method and talks about how we have a responsibility to train our dogs because their survival depends on it, because if they bite somebody that they're not supposed to bite, then they're going to be put down. Well, my dogs, like, they're not trained. They just are so close to me that they know what they're supposed to do.
Right, but it's,
and
what,
I know that
moving
sounds
into
crazy.
No, but listen,
Ion told me when I first talked, one of the first questions I ever asked Ion back at BobFest was like, how could I improve my animal communication skills? And they said, don't make it about that. If you don't make it about communicating with the animals, then the mountains will dance and, you know, all of nature will bow down to you, basically. And that's the experience I have with my animals. They're part of me. So maybe
Donna, so here's Donna, who has to keep teaching. And, you know, to go and take a course of someone who's talking about how she loves her animals is ridiculous. But that's how poverty-stricken the academia was, because they didn't know how to get into the good stuff, so they had to go around in circles and end up celebrating their own personal whims.
Wondered that very thing. Like, how did she get so disconnected from what she was originally published for? And, like, her later talks, the ones that were posted that were given in 2014 when she's 70, it's very interesting, but there's no continuity. She's talking about the coral reef. She's talking about hyperbolic space and these art installation projects where people crochet a version of the reef. I mean, I'm like, where are you even going with this?
She fell back in her Thompson Quadner and commune hippie nature stuff of the 70s. Because, yes, they will end up going back in holopathic and replaying earlier parts themselves, going in circles, if they don't know our stuff. So here's what Croker is trying to make something out of her and make her relevant. So he says, it is not as if her writings have sought to avoid the extremes, or for that matter, suffer any particular sense of naivety about the likely irreconcilability of the hard elementary forces of nature with which they engage. It's not that. More than most, her theoretical imagination paints a truly bleak, chillingly antiseptic, but for all that, a relentlessly dynamic vision of the power of technology. Here, the language of technology as human destiny achieves something of a reluctant scientific crescendo. Never constrained by limited vision or held back by any particular loyalty to the idea that the reality principle of social domination should be watered down in the process of its critical discovery and diagnosis, Haraway's writings reveal the apocalypse as possibly the contemporary end condition of hundreds of years of Western scientific experimentalism. So in other words, he's saying that she's not too impressed with science at some point. So her nerdiness has collapsed. Not a temporarily limited... she's somehow struggling, and Croker thinks she made it out. Not a temporarily time-oriented limited set of observations. Haraway takes us back historically to the philosophical and anthropological origins of the scientific episteme, or meme, in the book Primitive Visions, and reflects on the doubled futures of hybrid bodies, that's in her manifesto phase, simians, cyborgs, and women, and then the genetically engineered human-animal-plant laboratory remixes, that's her book Modest Witness, all this with a steadfast commitment to the ideal of the companion species manifesto in the context of a critical materialist study of gender, race, culture, and class framed by the informatics of domination. So there it is, the chemical body, gender, race, culture, and class, upset at the leviathan of discarnate penis screwing them up. It's called informatics of domination. So she's still trying to run from nature, run from the media, the android mean. It says, refusing to confront the will to technology directly, so he's sort of pretending she does it subtly, in terms of its own justificatory framework of understanding, Haraway always productively works the edges of dominant discourse, exploring the experimental history of paleontology and anthropology, the vivisected histories of chimpanzees and apes, questions of sexual dimorphism, the forgotten histories of storytelling, of art exhibitions, of TV programs, of scientific visions gone right, gone astray, gone mad, that would be quadriphenic, as ways of drawing into sharp visual relief the logic of nihilism that is at the heart of the language of science. So do you see that in her? She's pointing out the nihilism in the scientific techno project. Did you pick that up anywhere?
She is, but then she talks about staying with the problem and how we're living... And this is another thing that I thought was interesting. She talks about when you live in nihilistic times, and the earth is hanging in a balance because everything's all fucked up, that joy and beauty are very important as we stay with these problems.
But she's relying on old first nature beauty, or maybe some communication with
it definitely is. And she talks about how beauty used to be a luxury, but now it's something that everyone's able to enjoy if they want to.
Right. So Croker is projecting the nihilist thing, and he's already written about that a long time. And so he says, not, of course, that she ever really discusses nihilism, which is agreeing with you. She doesn't talk. She talks about the positive or the new kind of positivity, but she would not be able to take Ion saying, get over that. Now, she as a teacher needs to tell people something, so she's still grasping on something to tell people. You know what I'm, you see what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm.
And so she's, she's found this love value or whatever it is that you say she's talking about. That is, so she can still remain in touch with human beings. She has not totally killed herself, disconnected herself yet. She's not gone through the black hole of the vanishing point. And that's why she ends up weird and quadriphenic unconsciously and all backwards and still talking. And you're going, what are you trying to tell me now? You know? You're complaining
about
it.
I really didn't understand what, like, I thought a lot of it was super interesting, but I couldn't see continuity and I couldn't see how it all fit back in. And, like, I was surprised also if she was going to be so groundbreaking in her initial work with cyborgs. You would think that she would revisit that at some point with Web 2.0.
Well,
like,
I don't think
she go back
it.
Now?
She didn't understand the cyborgian. She just started talking about it as a factor that, you know, academics and feminists have to consider. The fact she didn't stay with it means she doesn't understand it. So it's interesting what Coker says in the next paragraph. He's sort of creating a value for her. He says she's a truly transformative scientist. So she represents a scientist who actually changed her view about her media, about her laboratory, about what the work of science is. And she, I guess, got alienated from it. But Coker is seeing transformation changing as a value, and that's still a cop-out when you get into Iandom. So here's what he says about that. Always the last and best representative of a truly transformative scientist, Haraway is a trusty guide to the study of hybrid bodies. So she's a trusty guide, he says, to Dobbstown. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. Because her thought represents the self-reflexive logic of scientific cosmology. In other words, the old 19th century landscape of the chemical body is that generally, and the vision of the biologist specifically. Reading Haraway is to migrate into the recursively looped consciousness of the scientific imaginaire, beyond the radical experiments by which natural scientists seek to make of the world a process of ground truthing, and even beyond the necessarily complicated reasons for the rise and fall of particular scientific epistemes or memes, to that fateful collision in the materiality of everyday life and death, the fluid datum of race, gender, class, and sexuality, wherein scientific reason meets its materially inscribed body, the logic of horse and train, again and again. So he's sort of implying she's still stuck in that. Definitely not a historian of science in the strict sense, nor an aspirant to social utopia. Haraway makes up her own thought, a knot of hybridities. In other words, she's doing the five-body mixture and probably not too consciously. This might explain why she can so fully and powerfully reveal the logic of scientific nihilism without once explicitly evoking the concept herself or itself. Probably as a creative forerunner of an insurgent perspective struggling to be born, a perspective which thus far has gone nameless, except perhaps in the bulky nomenclature of A-liberals, A-normals, and A-humans. Now, that's what an INET is. A-normal, A-human, and A-liberal, that's the majority of the quadriphenic population. And Coker doesn't want to admit that we're what they're looking for. So because she can't do that, Haraway exemplifies the double logic at the heart of nihilism. So she's all tied up in knots, which is the way she comes across. In
it really
video,
is.
Right?
Yeah.
And you luckily have the perspective of, you know, RNA drops and new chromosome 14 and that you can just sit back and mock this, quote, genius, you know, with your subgenius attitude. If the image of Neil...
Well, I liked her too much to really mock her. She really is...
Well, she brings out your inner
very
nerd.
Endearing.
Your inner nerd, reaffirms. Yeah.
And
but
the whole
you still
thing
say
with
no.
The dog.
You still... Yeah, and yeah, the old pet species, you would like that. But you're still looking at her saying, I don't know if I'd have her over for dinner. She is a little weird.
She's super weird.
Yeah. So,
she also did
Haraway,
this whole thing with fiber art.
Yes,
And string games and, like, Cat's Cradle. So when she loves the thought of girls playing string games together, and so one girl makes the Cat's Cradle and the other girl's going to have to hold a space for the person to take that out of their hands and make something else with it, like Jacob's Ladder.
Right.
And I thought that was beautiful, but again, I didn't get where she was going with that. And then she did
that's
this
nostalgia.
Whole thing where
she's still a mother. Yeah, she's still a mother. You know, still tending the nest at the commune, still helping the kids that the commune members gave birth to and giving them little crafts. She is really still in the Thompson quadrant. So So Croker says, if the image of nihilism can conjure up apocalyptic visions of a deracinating technological logic seeking to reduce nature and humans, or social nature, to a passive instrumentality in the service of what Nietzsche alluded to as the nothingness within, now that's what most people feel, if nihilism is used to show where people are pissed today, then nihilism also has an opposite transformative dimension. In other words, you can flip nihilism into a tetradically into a service. So this would be the singular contribution of Heidegger's Nietzsche. So Heidegger had a certain view of Nietzsche, that nihilism is itself the essential destiny of contemporary Western being because there is always and only a space for discovering the indwelling, the possession of technology, within the materiality of its most despotic moments. Which is why I would suggest, Croker says, Haraway is the name given today to the unfinished dialogue between Nietzsche and Heidegger, the name crafted in critical material scholarship out of the violence of the entanglement of science and the contemporary human condition. In other words, the violence of obsolete science. And Carol's got even new information about that nonsense right today. Ironically, Croker says, it is in the elegant sweep of Haraway's thought, this, the most radically destabilizing feminist of feminists, the most radically deconstructive Marxist of Marxists, describing Haraway, the most radically self-reflexive scientist of scientists, that we can finally discover in her something of the essential truth of the destiny that is the contemporary historical project of technology. So what is that destiny? And here's one more little paragraph. What does he say that? It is for Haraway neither a constructivism that would be fully abstracted, so it's not going to be whatever constructivism means, nor a realism that would be non-relational, but something else. Here we are finally present at the crossing over that Nietzsche could only hint at, the indwelling that Heidegger could only speculate about, the hybridities of which so many feminist theorists, including Lucy Irigoyen, that's someone back in France, and Helene Cicciaux, they're baby boomer level, old-fashioned feminists, the hybridities which those types could only dream of. Here we are, in fact, brought into the presence of a transformative possibility in the logic of science itself. Now, we know that Ion represents that, but takes it beyond science. From the brutality of the science of primates, a primate vision of the commingling of species, animals, discourses, feminism, struggles against racism, colonialism, homophobia, that's all the old chemical part of her gay life, from the brutality of that, from the seductions of the new universal language of the genome, a multiple diverse co-constituting sense of new social communities that would not be genomic but creative remixes of culture and nature, that would be my holopathic replay, and humans and animals, that's what she's counting on, the remix of culture, nature, and humans and animals, and the spirit earth, sounds like she even got a little bit of the astral body in there. It is always unpredictable in which thinker. So he's trying to figure out which thinker is the top thinker. So it's unpredictable in which thinker the spirit of the scientific times will find its fullest approximation and overcoming. Always a matter of fate with which theoretical pathway will align. It's always a matter of fate which theoretician or scientist their pathway will align itself with the broader historical trajectory of the times in which we live. Well, that's obviously me and Connie. But
obviously.
I think, yeah, but Croker doesn't know that. He says, but I think it might be said with some confidence that in these dark times, see, still living in the Bush era, there's an unmistakable sign of a certain critical illumination reflected by and in itself carrying forward the thought of Donna Haraway. So he sees Donna as our breakthrough. In her thought, there's an answer just waiting to be heard. Oh, yeah, we don't quite get there. There is an answer just waiting to be heard to the larger philosophical enigma concerning the fate of the body, identity, and ourselves, in fact, namely, now that we have achieved the universal homogeneous state of technology that was Hegel's vision of fully realized history. Is there a difference that would be transformative of science itself, a difference that would turn the future certainty of natural apocalypse into a greater human hope? Well, Mr. Croker, you're listening to it. And in terms of... and let's just replay. It always works out. I didn't know this would happen. But he's saying these dark times when there's... What is the fate of the body, identity, and ourselves? Well, would they go as far 60 years ago that problem was spelled out by this guy?
Now, the... The safety car is somewhat in that way related to In Cold Blood. In Cold Blood, as you know, some of the reviewers have been puzzled. They figure that the whodunit means probably Capote did it. Because Kenneth Tynan, you see, his figures that the murderer was the author. Alternatively, the reader. It's one of the two. And now remember when King Oedipus set out to discover who done it. His some evil had been done in his kingdom, and he was determined to find out who done it, and he found out soon enough he had done it. In any highly involved, intricate feedback network, it is impossible to say he done it. I saw him. Get him. In an electric society where everybody affects everybody at the same moment, it is impossible any longer to say he done it. It's just as realistic to say I did it. And so, again, at instant speeds of involvement of people in people, not only is there no possibility of assigning guilt for the things that people formerly had legalistically assigned guilt, there is also the difficulty of even knowing who we are. That is, personal identity becomes a real problem. The big headache of our time, existentially and so on, is who am I? How do you know who you really are? Well, the existentialists are simply responding to electric circuitry. After centuries of wheel and slow movement, if you move suddenly into the dimension of instant electric circuits, the problem of who I am or who we are becomes a serious one, because identity had for centuries been assigned to the matter of classification. I am a Hungarian, I am a dentist, I have six kids. That was identity. 50 years ago, people could be sure of who they were that way. Today, that no longer serves as human identity.
Well, what do you think of what McLuhan's saying there? You like that?
I love it. I liked it the first time you played it.
Right. Now, tell your local lawyer there's not a possibility of assigning guilt anymore, sir. You're obsolete.
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing? Zappa used to say in the 80s, there are too many lawyers. He may not have known this, but isn't that amazing? So I ended my whole career at CKLM, the last show, I talked about the difference between guilt and shame. And pre-literate cultures are involved with shame, not guilt. They don't even have individuality to assign guilt. But then we went through the literate phase and assigned individual guilt, and then we came back into the electric age of shame being retrieved. And you have most people running around to find a sleeve for their shame, which is the, converse of bliss is contrast. So we're looking for contrast. We're looking for a problem that I'm ashamed that I'm allowing it to happen. And you can see that Ion breaks through that meme, but everybody should know that the guilt factor has diminished in the populace, and it's all about sort of typecasting whether you were an abortionist or not, or whether you did abortion, heavily infused with shame. And you'll see a lot of people recovering. They go into depression when they start to become aware of themselves. They even on the drops get a little depressed sometimes. That's the shame mm-hmm. factor that's coming out of them. And they may call it, since they're literate baby boomers and that, they may call it guilt. But the shame factor is a lot of the what people call depressed. So bipolar is the population not understanding the seduction of shame, which is more about public issues. And so here's Donna Haraway asking us to be ashamed of the project of science and to come up with a solution to that, or some kind of cuddling with your pets as an antidote to the shame. And that's her looking for a basis of shame, which is all that the academics have. And that's also where political correctness came in. Political correctness is dealing with cultural archetypes or shame. That's why they get the next point. That's why everybody's totally immoral in the old literate sense in their private lives. And Roosevelt, like Eleanor, totally immoral according to the values of America in the 30s and 40s in her private life. But nobody heard about that. But she was very active in the shame issues of whatever she represented, maybe justice and having people not starve. But the shame, the collective issues are what we have to be rigorous about. The politician has to be perfect on the political correctness level. And yet, personally, he's a dangling, horny ganglia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not even an issue anymore for most people because the chemical body's gone. But that's what is called the Gary Hart syndrome. He was the first politician to really get nailed on that point. His personal morality was made him ineligible to be a president, even though every president up to that point secretly was not clean or perfect or Puritan. But
right.
It became a public issue.
Eleanor's husband was crippled with polio.
And he hid that? He hid that from the people?
Yep. And tried to stand on his braces and all that kind of stuff. Why was he married to a woman? I know this is a tangent. Why were they married if she was a lesbian? Like, what was their alliance based on then?
Well, I think that many people of that generation, which is they're born in the before 1900, those guys, and so they're before my generation. They're my parents, so they were totally seduced by the radio era or the idea of being famous and having a media image. So he took on, he was like the first president to really make a big deal out of using the radio with his fireside chats. So he was so dedicated and thought it was meaningful to be effective as a radio icon that the chemical body issues were minor. He probably wasn't even attracted to that. There is a movie about this. A couple of years ago, did you see that, where it's about the affair he had during the war with some woman up in New England or someplace, that he would go up to his summer parties. Did you ever see that? Maybe someone could post that if they know that movie. It was just a couple of years ago. That shows you, he was immoral in the Christian sense. He was having an affair with this woman through his adult life. But I would say that they actually believed in virtual reality back then, that it was important to communicate and be an image and hold the nation together. And that probably diminished chemical body issues for them privately.
They just did a PBS thing on the Roosevelts. It was on for many nights over the summer.
Okay. Now,
here's what
predicted. What? Okay. What were you saying?
It showed the girlfriend at in a particular time when Franklin was having bouts with his crippling and like needed to lose weight in order to stand on his braces in different times. He had her come instead of his wife.
What's interesting is Ion, if that is Ion posting on the chat line, he brings up Mary Hartman, which was a great TV show in the mid-70s. Interesting. Anyways, Ion's there running his own seminar on the chat line, if it is the real Ion. What happened? McLuhan in the Playboy interview predicted that in tribal societies, shame was important, so you didn't get divorced. Saving face was very important. Now, maybe they didn't live exactly like that to the level of privacy, but you did not get divorced. So he thought that people would come back, would get over the sexual revolution. That was a period of transition and all that happened there, the anarchy, and then they would become the rabid family, representing family and family values and making a big deal of not being divorced. Now, that did happen in the 80s. You know how that happened?
No.
It happened in the resurgence of Christian moral majority, at least as an image.
Oh.
Why did so many horny business execs in the 70s suddenly start showing up at church and reading the Bible? I mean, I knew a lot of these guys, They were entering into shame about how they lost control of their chemical body when they were during the anarchy of the 60s, 70s, and then they wanted to, repent about it. And so much of the revitalization of the Christian image through televangelism, which became mandatory, you had to have that audience for to be president, you had to be a born-again Christian from Carter on, that is the thing predicted by McLuhan, that saving face became a big deal. And so family values came back in Reagan land, and that's been around. Now, what's interesting is the five bodies eventually scattered that. So the moral majority and Jerry Falwell decided they lost that war of the value of saving face. They lost the shame thing. And that's where you get into my stuff and the extreme level of five bodies and then to ION. You know what I mean? As
yep.
Dealing with this desire to save face. So just a side point about how a McLuhan prediction partly came true. And McLuhan,
well,
and Kath, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, now all the shame, when we did the Paul Williams thing and talk about the addiction literature.
Yes, yeah.
Everybody who's on Oprah now is dealing with their shame. Like, I'm so ashamed, so I eat, so I drink, so I gamble.
Yes, but, yes. Oprah came in on the shame culture. Now, Oprah is a result of the shame culture in the 80s. That's exactly right.
Okay.
And, you know, if you just knew that guilt... See, people wonder, okay, why are people... I've heard people say, well, that person, she's ashamed of what she did, but she's actually a nut on the weekend and fucks anything that moves. And, like, they couldn't figure out what they were shameful about. Well, what they were shameful about was their TV landscape, but not their chemical body. And you can't figure out this oddness, this weirdness in latent quadrophenia unless you use the five bodies. Otherwise, people, McLuhan doesn't make sense, or any of Donna Harris doesn't make sense. There's something more going on than our categories of conversation can frame. But my stuff does. It makes it why people are quadrophenic.
Definitely.
Like, you know, look at this Denver guy. I mean, alcoholic, a junkie even? Did he even get into heroin?
John Denver?
Yeah. No, Paul Williams. Did he get into
Paul
heroin?
No, cocaine was his drug.
Yeah, cocaine.
Cocaine and alcohol.
Look at this. Mm-hmm. For years he's abusing himself. And then he thinks he gets a big spiritual revital by writing a book and getting on time, being ashamed of it. It's all part of the processing. There's no beginning and ending. He's going to go back to using cocaine when this whole shame, this whole book thing doesn't work out the way he's hoping it to work out, you know. Then he'll go down into a spiral again. We can predict it. None of these people will be successful at what they claim they're writing about and have gotten religion over if they don't understand the dynamic of the five bodies. And usually that requires a few RNA drops to even be able to handle that.
Yeah, definitely.
So, very good, Katie. Very good ideas, or at least sparking our minds to come up with fake solutions while Ion waits in the wings, ready to blast everybody, if he even will. Look, he has here win, lose, or place the blame.
Do you want to hear you want to wrap up, Donna, and do you want to hear a little bit about what she thinks about, like, about genomes? I thought that was kind of interesting.
Okay.
So she became, because of her canine interest, she said she had to really set aside prejudice that she had about eugenics, because when you get really into breeding dogs, and she's into this Australian Shepherd, that's her main thing that she likes, like, she knows this woman who's kind of responsible for that whole genome. And it's an animal, you know, it's not the human genome, but how she really had to set aside her prejudices about eugenics and keeping that whole purebred species pure. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, explain it a little bit. What is she, I don't know what the issue is. She never liked genetics? Is that the beginning bias?
Eugenics. Like what Hitler did.
Oh, eugenics. Is she? Okay,
yeah.
That's not politically correct. So what does eugenics apply? In what way does she approve?
It keeps the species of dogs pure. Like, they wouldn't necessarily put dogs down. But when you have contracts with your breeder about whether you're going to fix your dog or let it breed, or who you're going to let it breed with. And she made a statement that she knows, like, 9,000 generations or something, the number is probably wrong, of her dog, but she doesn't even know the names of her great-grandparents. It kind of reminded me of, like, what Michael Brown was saying, how he's, like, he doesn't agree with racial prejudice whatsoever, but then when he went back to South Africa and he wanted to go bowling with a bunch of racist guys, he was able to just kind of overlook it and hang out with them and get rid of his prejudices, because he was in a situation where it made sense to do that. This is a similar thing that she's saying with, like, genetic purity.
Let me respond to Michael. So there's Michael. He's doing all his bodies, but he really values having a chemical body experience, so he's going to throw off the old chemical body biases and hang out with some races because he's so desperate to have a chemical body experience, which now is archetypal because he doesn't get it much because he's involved with the other bodies. So that's an example where he's not thinking clearly about the factors involved. You can easily be tolerant on the chemical body level today because it doesn't matter. Nobody cares. And most people who are racist, that they're doing a put-on in the global theater. I mean, these guys in college that rape women, they're doing it as a performance, right? Date rape. They're doing it to talk about their chemical body guys, and they can be really fanatic about it. So people can be more violent, and McLuhan predicted this, more violent in the chemical body issues as an art form because it's not as important as a chip body. See, there's a
wow.
We're talking about a new level of a hypocrisy here, a new kind of hypocrisy.
Right.
So she's all worried about eugenics in the chemical body and among humans. She wouldn't accept that, but she's saying, well, it's okay in the animal, which she seems to have a becoming fetishistic about. She's so concerned.
Yes.
It's like these people have a conscience. They've got this chemical body conscience that must be applied somewhere, and you can't apply it out there in a chip body world, so you apply it to some old issue like your pet, and you make a fetish out of it, and you start teaching it and writing books about it. I mean, this is becoming infantile. This is what Wyndham Lewis used to complain about, that the worship of the child in the 20s and 30s was a result of people not understanding that the electrified discarnate condition had taken over, and then people were starting to get neurotic and getting immature and starting to become emotionally a 10-year-old. Now we're the emotionally of a squidbilly, 2-year-old is everybody.
Right.
So, and if you don't know the causes, you just get swept along. And so I complain that Croker, he's pretty good at defining the causes, but he always walks right up to Ionic doorstep and then
And they
make the mistake of thinking Ion is in the Thompson quadrant, and we know Ion is not. Ion could do Donna Haraway.
They can't hear past the platitudes. They just hear the platitude. They don't hear the depth of the
That's right.
Allow.